You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Pop a top again.
908 on the left coast of the United States. Joining me from the center of the country is Michael Musselman. What's going on, Gunner?
What's up?
Nothing. It's hot in Texas today. What's going on?
Well, it's just warm, muggy.
Is it? Are you guys going to have a tropical storm for Christmas?
No, there's a cold front moving through. It was just slowed down.
Yeah, I saw.
Yeah, it was supposed to get cold. It's supposed to cool up.
I saw. It was like 60 degrees. And I was like, wow, they were just in the 30s. Yeah. What the hell happened?
Yeah.
Texas. There you go. If you want the weather to change, just hang out for a while. What's new? What's going on? What's exciting in your life?
What's exciting?
Yes.
Nothing. I don't want excitement anymore. I like just normal.
That's a constant. That's a theme of your life. If somebody said, "What are the themes of Mike's life to me?" I would say, normal.
Normal.
No drama. No surprise.
No drama. I avoid drama as much as I can.
He avoids people that on gun ranges that say the wrong thing.
I just avoid people that say the wrong thing in everything.
Oh, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of avoidance.
That's a lot of avoidance.
If you extrapolate that from the range to Lowe's, to Christina's, to every place you go, the gas station, people saying stupid stuff, that's a lot of avoidance.
I know. That's crazy, man.
So you're just happy rolling around your cowboy hat, avoiding people?
Not all the time, but yeah. I mean, I like meeting people. It's just meeting the right people. I don't like drama, and that's hard to avoid, you know, in today's world. Jeez. People like drama for some reason.
And you can't, when it does kind of visit you, like, I don't want to get sucked into it. And if I deal with this problem, there's four just underneath it that if you really don't want to hear what I have to say about that, okay? So I can't, don't draw me into this one, because it draws me into five, and I can't do that, because it'll end our friendship.
Well, it's weird, because, you know, as you... when they're in their drama and it's like, and then you give them some advice, like, oh, you know what? Then they get all upset. You just aren't, you know, like, God.
How could he be like that? I mean,
how is he so insensitive?
Yeah, so black and white and so insensitive.
It's easy to be black and white.
Well, look, we weren't hatched like this. The world made us like this. We're victims.
Oh, here we go, yeah.
Yeah, I want to be like everybody else, but I'm not. And life's made me like this. I want to be like Bill Clinton. It wasn't my fault, that whole thing with Monica Lewinsky. I was vulnerable. Thundercavs wasn't doing her wifely duty. Young girl pays attention to me, shows me her thong, and in a vulnerable moment, I became a victim. That's what we're like.
That's a good place. I like that.
Yeah. It wasn't Bill Clinton's fault. Come on. He was a victim. So, anyway, I'll roll that one out. People are like, are you serious with that shit? Like, hello? Of course. Do we need the President of the United States rolling around sexually frustrated? No. Not that one, anyway. So, anyway, an accused Russian agent.
Oh, no.
Pleads guilty.
For what?
Let's see. What was that girl that was rolling around? A woman accused of being a secret agent for the Russian government has pled guilty to a conspiracy charge in federal court in Washington, D.C. Maria Butina appeared in court after reaching a deal with prosecutors. As part of that deal, she said she tried to infiltrate the National Rifle Association and relay intelligence on American politicians to a Russian government official.
Very
Nice. So the NRA being infiltrated. She pleads guilty. How about, you know, I changed my mind about Michael Cohen and the foxhole. He's too much of a piece of shit. I can't do that. I have to choose one of the other two. I asked Mike the other day. We got an email that said Cohen, Comey, or Flynn in the foxhole. Who would you take if you had to take?
Yeah, I wouldn't take Cohen at all. Or I couldn't stand being around Flynn. I'd have to take Comey.
You have to take Comey? And then they couldn't just don't speak. You're never allowed to speak. Okay. I said Cohen because he just do what you told him to do. Because he's that guy. But let me tell you where he lost me. He goes into court the other day, and who did he have with him? He has his daughter, who you've never seen, his wife, and I've seen his son before on some videotape of him walking down the street in New York City. So for your sentencing, you're going to haul your daughter and your wife in for that? Why? Hoping the judge will see that and feel pity for you? Well, yeah. So you're using your family as stage props.
Right.
Why doesn't that surprise me? Now you're such a piece of shit. You can't even be in my fighting hole, even if you're not going to talk at all and just do my shit. So he violated that for me. So I had to rethink that. I had to rethink that whole thing.
Yeah, you know, I saw the headline, so I stopped reading about that stuff.
You avoided that? You know what? Let me tell you, the smartest thing to do is don't go near it. Stay away.
Yeah.
Stay away.
Don't engage with it, yeah.
You read Athena's book. I haven't.
Yeah, I'm almost done. I just sat just a couple more chapters ago.
Any thoughts on the book?
It's, wow. You know, she says in the book that it's not a formula, you know, on how it's not a how-to book. It's not like how to beat this. It's her way of beating this. And, you know, so as I read each chapter, I kind of put it down and then I think about things and I think about, you know, try and put it in perspective of things that I've experienced. And, you know, and so it comes back to me as, you know, how do people beat that? You know, those things that they're faced with. You know, she took it, you know, at the end of the interview yesterday, and I texted you and I said, wow, what a very strong personal last statement when you finished up and says, you know, is there anything else left that you know, I need to talk about? She said, you know, people have asked me if you could do it all over again, what would you do? And she said, I wouldn't change a thing. And people are really shocked by that. Like, well, I mean, you repeatedly raped and you were abused and you got this and you got that and you got dealt this. She's like, yeah. But look where she's at now. It's made her who she really is. And who she is, it's phenomenal. And that's what really kind of catches me is. So I sent her a text, and as I read the book, I came to the realization, and I sent her this text, and I said, you know, and you know this, I've read a lot of books. What things that really appeal to me are people that endure adversity and overcome. You know, and we've talked about Shackleton a lot on this program, you know, because he dealt with, you know, again, World War I going on, 1914. He's down in South America the Antarctic, and they get locked in ice and it becomes a survival, you know, and everybody writes him off as dead and rightfully so. I mean, again, it would have been one of those, had they all died, we would have understood.
Right.
It would have been like,
It was expected, right? I mean,
but that guy being who he was at the right place with the right people and they didn't lose a soul and they came out of it. And what the story really kind of tells is, you know, how to deal with adversity, you know, in every corner, everything that was dealt to him, he found the positive in it, in everything. And those are pretty extremes. But what I started to notice was, and then, you know, the guy who broke his legs climbing the mountain down in Peru or Chile and then crawled his way out, you know, again, his friends wrote him off as dead and he crawls out to the base camp and they're like, oh my God, you know, cause he overcame it. Even to some of the smaller degrees where, you know, the guy who got his arm pinned and he stayed there for 4 days. And then he realized, you know what, I can't get out of here. I got to rescue myself. And he cut his arm off. You know?
That's a crazy story. But, you know, I read, I didn't read all of it. I read probably the first third of Chuck Yeager's book. And he talked about conquering things. And he said, look, most of the people that conquer things, the truth is you don't have another choice.
Right.
And he was very matter-of-fact about it. He says, look, I remember going hunting up in the Sierras, and we walked across this huge sequoia that had fallen across a 1,000-foot chasm, you know, years ago. I don't know how long. He said, but it was a worn kind of a trough through the trunk of this tree that had been used for a long time. I got into the middle of it, and I got scared, and I got down on my knees, and I hugged the tree. And he said, I had this kind of moment of realization. I don't have any choice. Nobody's going to come out here and help me, you know, in the middle of this tree trunk. The only choice I have is to stay here and die, or crawl or walk to the other side of this thing. So I don't have a choice. And so I think that's interesting. But the caveat to that is, when you're faced with that in life repeatedly, to the extreme, that's different.
Well, you know, so they do have a choice, though, Mac. They can just give up.
You're right.
Well, they got, and like I said, you got three choices, right? You always got three choices. To do something about it, to not do something about it, or just allow whatever to happen. So, I mean, it's like, it's, they always say, it's, you can, there's three decisions you can make: a good decision, a bad decision, and no decision. You know, so I was putting this together, and I was thinking to myself, like, okay, how does this correlate to people that are faced with the suicide? So, weird thing happened today, and I was looking at through the headlines, I see this 35-year-old, pretty blonde girl from Detroit, meteorologist who took her life. You know, and I'm reading the article, and it talks about the five things you didn't know about her. One, she was a devoted mother and wife. She loved her husband. She loved her child. She loved her job. And so it's like, okay, well, this doesn't make sense. Okay, so reading on. And then she had LASIK done recently, and she was yearning to get back to work because that's what she really, really loved. And so I'm thinking to myself, I don't know the whole story, so I'm trying to draw the conclusion. So what would drive this young? They didn't come up with an answer. They didn't say she took her life because of this reason. She left a note. No. You know, so they're talking about how great she was, which I'm not taking that away. I'm saying, yeah, but what drove her to this point? And as you kind of look between the lines, maybe it was because it never said she got back to work. So maybe her eyes, something on her, something about her, she couldn't get back to where she was. So she felt it was never going to be the same again. So you get, you know, to the point and it's like, you're done. So as I'm reading that, then I see another article about a person taking her life recently. And this person took their life because of vanity, you know. Something had screwed up. They had some plastic surgery, didn't work out, and boom, they take their life. And I'm like thinking to myself, like, what in the world would compel you? You know, you think of all the reasons, or we say suicide's not an option. You know, or we don't say that, but that's what's said. Suicide's an option. We believe that suicide is an option. You have to take that option off the table, you know, and do something with it. Redirect the anger. Redirect the hurt. Redirect the betrayal. Whatever it is, redirect it to something positive. Instead of pointing it out. So the book has me thinking a lot about, like, wow, I never thought of it at this side. So in my eyes, really, Athena is just like a modern-day Shackleton, but just a different conditions. You know, Shackleton was faced with environmental conditions. I mean, and some mental stuff, you know, but more of the environment. The environment played a bigger role in his decision making. Whereas Athena's decision making was based on all purely mental. You know, what can I do with this? And as I have met women here or around that have faced these same kind of turmoils in their life, I look at the decisions that they've made and I fall into the category of the social of going, wow, you know, I feel bad for you. Yeah, it's true. I mean, life gave you a shitty deal and, you know, I can't blame you for it. When what should be doing is, no, I can blame you for it because you could have done something about it. You know, some of the greatest people make the best decisions in the world based on adversity. You know, when they come against that wall, that's when they become their greatest. I mean, think about it. We became, in some of the situations that we faced, we did our best work when we were up against the wall. You know, and I think about that a lot, like even in combat. So when you're in a firefight, you know, man, you just get so calm. Not everybody, but I mean, I was so calm. It was like, all right, see this thing through, do this, do that. Or doing a big scale operation with, you know, division live fire. Okay, got it. And then we kick it off and it's smooth because, you know, we turn, when we face adverse situations, we become our best. And that's what she did. And it's really an upfront, in-your-face book. You know?
Okay, let me draw a distinction. When those moments are going in slow motion, when we experience them, we prepared a lifetime for that shit. Right? I mean, we're talking about guys who are smart, devoted to their craft. I mean, beyond. I just had Jeff. Do you know Jeff Kenny, Colonel Ty?
Yeah.
I mean, guys like, you know, the guys that Mike and I are friends with, that are good friends, I mean, they're exceptional, in my opinion. They're exceptional people. Leaders, they're thoughtful, they're studious, all of that. And so when you in those situations, we prepare. In the situation, so the distinction I would draw is the situations that came at Athena, what prepares you for that in life?
Right.
You know, and then what's the difference between people that handle it and people that don't? Because this is a deep conversation, you know, and why some people go down a road because it becomes so black for them, and some people face with huge, I didn't even want to say adversity, huge darkness, because it's beyond adversity.
Yeah. What she faced was dark, pure darkness.
Yeah, so we left adversity about 4 miles back there. That was adversity. What we face now is this engulfing blackness that is, and yet you don't lose, you know, Stockdale in the Hanoi Hilton, you know, and you see this stuff. How do you give that to people? How do you explain that?
Right. How do you come out of that?
Where does it come from? That he doesn't see the blackness in it.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's just incredible. It's not adversity. So, I mean, to me, that would have been like adversity. Like, come on, that's a joke. You know, it's the black. Right. It's the blackness that engulfs you after the 8th horrible experience. Not bad, horrific experience happens to you. Then what? How do you find the perseverance? Where does that come from? So what's your answer?
I'm not there yet. I don't know. Right. I will be there. I will have an answer. As I read the book, what I'm going to do is, like I said, I'm very close to being done. I mean, I could be done today. I'm going to read it again. Yeah. And this time I'm going to use the yellow highlighter and tab everything out.
No, you know what? With good books, you have to, because there's so much in there, and it's almost, and it's
interesting. It's a great book. This is a great book.
It's interesting. The second time you read it, there's.
Yeah, what you missed. Yeah.
Right, what
or you,
you
see it in a different
time, right.
perspective. Yeah.
Right.
No. But I'm going to, so what I already have, I mean, I have a drawer full of them is the little, post-it note things, little sticky ones that we had in the Marine Corps,
right.
you know, the yellow colors,
right.
clear. So I tab out the book, I highlight stuff.
Right.
You know, so I'll write things down. And, you know, and like I said, you know, as I read this, again, it's like, why this, this should be a book. This should be a discussion. She should be on TED, first of all. So TED Talks. She should be talking on TED Talks. Because this is going upstream. Now we're, she's going up current. And how is she making it up current? Everybody else, is, society expects you to go with the flow. But Athena's not. She's heading up current. So how is she doing this? How did she get there? You know, and it's like, she's going to face, and she probably already has, and I know she said it once, but she's going to face huge criticism. But what she's going to face criticism from are people that are weak.
Let's talk about that, because she and I had a long, about an hour.
I listened to the whole thing.
No, no, after we got off the air.
Oh.
We had another hour and a half conversation after that. And about doing this in public and mm-hmm. And how social media emboldens the idiots on the planet and how much of that stake. Because, look, we're not talking about kind of a, some kind of episodic thing in your life. You're opening up your soul in a book like this, and then you're going to have people that, you know, read a paragraph or two or heard somebody say or saw a picture, and now they're going
to read the cover.
Right. They're going to comment on it, and but they're commenting about you, right? It's you. We're not talking about something you did or a truck you test drove. We're talking about you, your soul, your personal decisions. How much of that do you read? How much of that do you ingest? Because, you know, I'd like to say that that shit doesn't bother me, that it doesn't stick to me. But I'm, I'd be lying if I said that. It does bother me. You know, it does stick to me and I, it, it does affect me. But, and there's so much of it. How do you, how much of that do you read? How much of that do you ingest? I mean, we turn off the news. Right? I mean, and we both talked about, you know, the best case for the mass extinction of the planet is reading the comment section of anything posted anywhere. Go read 10 comments, you'll, and then you'll shut it off. It's just stupid, horrible shit. That's the planet that you live on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't, like I said, man, I don't get it. I really don't. I don't understand why people get upset over this.
Well, I mean, and the venom that they throw. To me, that,
oh.
that's the scarring part, right? Is the vent, the venom. It's like the shit that they would say. It's not like they would articulately disagree. Hey, you know, I read your book, and I just want to say that I think that this and this are mistaken conclusions. We all know it ain't shit like that.
Right.
It is personal venom, and you never met the person, and blah, 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 blah. So, yeah. So we were talking about that. I said, hey, make sure you filter that stuff, man. You don't need to read all that shit. Your job is to positively impact the lives of people, and you're doing that. And she was telling me the number of, you know, men who've reached out to her already who've been, you know, raped and assaulted and said, wow, I never thought I'd do this with a woman, but I read your book and it touched me and I just wanted to reach out to you and say hi and thank you for giving me the courage. I'm going to begin to share my story. I'm like, that's the Grinch moment. And, that I said that Mike and I we're addicted to and when you help others. But the other shit that comes with it, I know it sounds a little bit, I don't want to say a cop-out because it's not, but to not read that stuff. But if it's intelligent criticism, I'd be all about it. Yeah, absolutely. But if it's just the garbage that comes with social media, get it out of here. Mm-hmm. You know, get it out of here. So I don't know how you filter it, but anywho.
Yeah, it's but yeah, she needs to get out there and you know, I'm dying to meet her, you know, in person. And because she looks and sounds everything like, you know, that I love, you know, that I'm comfortable with. And, you know, it's a shame that she had to go through that. You know, so her story reminded, when she was getting NJP, there was I don't think you remember this, but there was a young gal who was attached to us from CLB-1, I think it was, the CLB unit that was there.
Which,
is that right, CLB-1?
Which deployment?
When we were in Dwyer.
Yeah.
In Dwyer.
I can't remember which CLB was there, to be honest. There was probably a couple, right, while we were there?
Yeah, it was in Dwyer. But I think it was, well, yeah, it was someone with the combat logistics at the time. And she was a Lance Corporal. And I had to deal with her when I was building that Afghan village over there in the back corner by EOD.
Right.
So what I needed from her was materials and then her to draft everything up and do her engineering stuff. And, man, she was phenomenal. And, you know, and such a young girl. I mean, she was probably 19 years old. And at first I was like, oh, this is who they gave me. You know, I was like, oh, God. All right. And so I started to speak to her, like, you know, talking, like, okay. And she was getting it right away. She didn't say anything. And she came back, and my expectation was set pretty low. And when she came back with me, the plan and everything else, it was like, holy shit. I said, do you have an actual engineering degree? She's like, oh, no, sir. I said, man, this is freaking awesome. So we implemented the plan. She was part of it. We helped. And then she did a lot of the HE stuff. She, no matter what I needed, she was there. As a Lance Corporal, what I didn't know was she was taking a lot of grief in her unit for doing this. You know, because she was cutting corners. She was getting it done. She was making it work. And so I found out she was taking a lot of heat from her gunning, you know, and finally I was like, what? And so I talked to the gunny and I said, listen, let me ask you something. Why are you giving, you know, Lance Corporal Jane Doe here? What's the beef? What's the problem? Oh, sir, there's, you know, she needs to do it this way and fill out this form and do this and do that. And I'm like, fuck, relax. It's not the end of the world, man. The equipment's here. It's not like we're bringing it in a country. We're transporting it by a ship or buying it from frickin' Ukraine, you know, and doing open contracts. It's here. It's not being used. She's getting people to do it. And she's not taking away from the mission. I know, sir, but that's just not the way. And I said, like, listen, there's nothing that you've ever done outside of the, you know, here's the path I'm supposed to be on, and I stray outside of it because it's not as, the path is not, is not readily conducive to what I need to do, mm-hmm. and I need to step outside of that. You've never done that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sir, I said, I live my life like that. I see the book, the rule book, and it's like, throw it out the window. People were like, well, you got to follow. Well, no, because if I break the rules, they'll tell me. Someone will be there, believe me, that'll tell me you can't do that. And 9 times out of 10, when they say you can't do that, you can. They've just never been done before. And then when you do it that way, people, you know, some people look at you like, wow, okay, great. Or some people will be calling an asshole. And it's like, whatever. Either way, it's a compliment. And so she was doing this for me. She was knocking it apart. I talked to Gunny, and I was livid. And finally, the same thing, you know. And then I actually, because she was doing this for, God, we did it. I think it took three months. And I wasn't there all the time. So she was, you know, I was out doing my thing, you know, so I had my other job to do. And so I left her in charge of it, a lot of it, until we got to the EOD part where they were wiring it. But even all that stuff going up, she knocked it out of the park, man. And then I wrote up a Navy achievement, you know, for her to her command, because we couldn't give it to her. So I gave it to her command. And then I contacted, I think it was her sergeant, and I said, hey, here's the pros and cons that I believe that she rates for your next counseling session, because she's working for me, and here you go. And here's the counseling sheet. Everything that she accomplished, it was like 3 or 4 pages long. You know? And he was really good about it. He's like, you know, I really appreciate this, sir. You know, no one really does it like this. And I'm like, God, you guys are just horrible. And she's right. You see the way women are treated in units that have women a lot. And I asked her, you know, we were talking about it. I said, how were you treated with the infantry? And she goes, oh, like, you know, like a Marine. And I said, yeah, you know why? Because that's, even though they act dumb and they most of the time they can be dumb, they're good guys. And they see it clear as day that if you prove yourself, you're a Marine, you're a Marine. It doesn't matter what you are.
The meritocracy, right?
Right.
The meritocracy. But I will say this, don't go drinking with them.
No, because they're stupid.
Right.
And, you know, they'll make dumb decisions, but they're good guys.
No, and we know, you know, it is a meritocracy, especially when you're doing shit where people can get killed. I mean, it doesn't matter really what your rank is. If you're good at something, right, hey, get him out of here. Get her in there, right? She's fucking good. Well, but you, sir, you don't understand, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, I understand.
Right.
I understand. She gets it done. She has her head in the game. She helps. She makes us better. I don't care who he is, and I don't care if it's his fucking term, right? So the meritocracy of that. But again, the hard part for women is you feel that, right? You get treated. And then there's a social piece to this. And it's, you know, and it sucks. You know,
yeah.
You're nice to me. What does that mean? That means you want to have sex with me, right? Right. Wrong.
Right.
And so, and then after we have like 4 or 5 drinks, you certainly want to have sex with me, right? Right. Wrong.
Right. Now you're all, yeah.
And so it's, that's why the whole, you know, and again, right now in the Marine Corps, women represent 8% of the force. 8%. That ain't a whole lot. And so, no, I mean, it's a tough experience. And then let alone to have life load up on you like it loaded up on her before she even got there. So now, and again, would it, to take it back to the original, your original question, like, you know, who was Shackleton? I almost said Ford. I should know by now. But I'm learning where did that come from in him? Did it come from something that his parents told him?
Upbringing? No. Because she's the classic example. Her upbringing. Her parents didn't teach her that.
What made him like that? What made her like it? What makes people like that?
That's the million-dollar question.
And why would you... Because I've got a number of calls from... Mike and I will be out at Camp Lejeune, first week of the...
Lejeune.
In the first... That's what I said, Lejeune. I can't believe you'd insult his family like that. But anyway, I got a number of calls because I think they're doing some kind of brief about it today. I got a number of calls yesterday. Well, you know, when you guys, are you guys going to talk about suicide specifically? And I said, well, yeah, you know, but it's not going to be a suicide class, okay? It's part leadership. It's part resiliency. You know, but I don't like, it's not like, is it a resiliency class? No, it's not. It's, this affects all of us. I would say it skews more to leadership than it does resiliency, but we're going to make you smart about living with trauma and how Marines have done it for decades. And
right.
And so like, all right. So, you know, so, but again, these are all issues that plague a nation, that plague a public school system, a university system, a culture where your children now grow up with without a lot of structural support. Whatever you want to do is okay. And as long as you're doing what makes you happy, then that's fine. How does that kind of coincide with the structure and discipline that you need, you know, in a different part of your life? And the answer is there's a collision that happens there. Mm-hmm. And I had a really interesting conversation. I quoted our conversations a couple times, Mike, about staff NCOs in the Marine Corps and how we've totally emasculated and taken their power away. And so, you know.
Oh, yeah. And people argue and say, no.
Well, we have this program. We have that program. And I say, look, you know, if I asked Mike Musselman when he was a corporal, right, when his platoon sergeant looked at him and his platoon and said, hey, nobody touches the new joins. Everybody got it? Would he have defied his platoon sergeant when he was a corporal and got him up at 2 in the morning, shaved their heads, and then had them say, we don't have the right to own to have hair yet? The answer to that would have been laughable. No. Why? Because he would have had my ass. Would he have punched you in the face? No. He would have played fuck with me. I would have been on every working party. He would have wasted my time. He would have taught me a lesson about defying
me. Let me interject. If I was screwed up, if I was not who I was, and you asked me that question, I would say, yeah, I would. I would have done exactly the opposite of told. You know why? Because as a corporal, my staff NCOs were a joke. A flaming joke. My gunny, I don't even think he was maybe sober 2 times a week.
Whoa.
They were a joke. My staff NCOs, they got paid. I mean, did they teach me anything? Yeah, they taught me what not to be when I got to that rank. Who, what not to do. There's another one. Don't ever do that. Oh. So I say I learned me the only, you know, I'm thinking back again. Mac, I came in at the same time you did, but a different world. You're an officer and your world was different coming in the Marine Corps entry level, but we were in the mid 80s.
Right.
And the Marine Corps was not a pleasant place. It was a tough place. You had to fight to survive. And you had to be careful because there's a line. If you were exceptional and you wanted to succeed, then you're a kiss ass and you get your ass beat. So you wanted to be well liked. Well, that was, if you wanted to be accepted and be a buddy, well, that was smoking or taking drugs and then drinking on the weekends excessively. And being, you know, a dumbass and being smarting up. I mean, it was cool when people would smart up to NCOs. They thought they were cool and it was expected of you. And you knew which ones to do it to because those were the weak ones. Now, you know, like I say, Sergeant Roy was one of the guys, one of the few NCOs when I first came in. Him and Brewer, Corporal Brewer was my other one and Brewer became a chief warrant officer, was a range officer. And Tim Brewer was a phenomenal Marine. And Brewer wore my ass out when I screwed up, but he praised me when I did well. So that was the first, like, holy crap, this is what a corporal is supposed to be like. I would have followed that guy to, you know, Hell's Gates. But I saw around me the other ones, no way. Shitbags. Taking advantage of being a corporal, you know. Corporal Jones has got duty tonight, but my other buddies are going out. So, hey, Lance Corporal Musselman, you're now duty. I'm going to be gone. Don't tell anybody. If anybody asks for me, I tell them I'm sleeping. You know, so someone comes and says, hey, where's Corporal Jones? You're like, sleeping. Go show me where he's sleeping. Now I just lied to this individual.
Right.
Another NCO. You know, so you get put in these positions, and what I started to find out was friends don't put friends in positions like that. And that became one of my statements. It was people would say something, and I'd go, you know, no, I'm not going to do that. Or, you're not my buddy? No, I am your buddy, but I'm asking you the question now, too. If you were a friend of mine, you would put in a position to do that, to compromise my moral convictions. Friends don't do that of one another. That's what a real friend is. A real friend isn't someone that's going to lie for you. A real friend is someone that's not going to put you in a position to lie. You know, and so it was a tough way to get through, but yeah, my growing up, and like I told you, what my people, my mentors, the people that I looked up to were my lieutenants, my captains, and then started becoming the officers. Not all of them, but most of them, all the ones that I had the opportunity to work with, and I worked with some of the greatest, AJ Kostick, Steve Petingolo, you know, Jeffrey J. Chirac, you know, so Royal Mortensen, you know, I was a developing young corporal. These guys were my lieutenants and captains. Dan Altman, you know, later became General Altman. All these guys, just phenomenal. Battalion commanders. I had Colonel Moffitt. You know, Moffitt became a general. One of the greatest battalion commanders that anybody could ever had when I was first coming in. You know, again, because Lance Corporal's never talked to Lance Corporal or a colonel. Is that I'm sitting outside a tent as a private with a radio on my back at Prick 77, freezing my ass off, waiting for my lieutenant to get done with this meeting, because we hiked all the way there because we couldn't afford to leave the one Jeep, take the one Jeep from the platoon because they needed it.
The Jeep.
Yeah, so the, you know, the 151 was back at the battalion or the company position.
But I don't want to talk about them kind of as role models. This is my perspective as a lieutenant with a second lieutenant at Charlie 15. You know, my staff sergeant was a high school dropout. But when he told them to do something, they did not defy him.
Yeah, because he would beat his ass.
I don't know that he had to at that point.
Yeah, come on, yeah.
But
a young lieutenant, there was some ass kicking going on.
Well, let me tell you. They were afraid of him.
Right.
And to me, what I'll say is today in the Marine Corps, I think we've taken everything away from our staff and COs. It's not an easy job, and Mike would tell you that, and I would agree with him. We have quality issues there, right? But we've also taken everything away from them, in my opinion, and it's not an easy job.
And but you have to lead from the front.
I agree with you. But you're a bad example in all this because you're exceptional. So I want to talk about the average guy and how does that guy do it, not the exceptional guy, because the exceptional guys will find a way to lead and be inspirational leaders by the way they do it. Not everybody can do it that way. So, you know, so how does it work? I had a conversation with somebody recently about, you know, what if they consider a traumatic event simply checking into the unit? What?
And it could be, yeah.
Okay, then you have to deal. Then if they because of all the shit they've heard, to me there's two issues. One, you've got to address that. Two, the other issue you have to address at some point, and this takes us back to the previous conversation, is the lawlessness in your barracks when a staff NCO.
Is not there,
is not listened to, is not feared. When somebody can be told, don't haze them a million fucking times and go fucking do it anyway.
Right.
And it's not just happened a little bit. It's happening to the point where the commanding general of the 1st Marine Division felt it was an epidemic, right, and called everybody out. I just feel like a thousand Lance Corporal flipped me the bird, and I'm not having this. And then he got called out for that. And he was exactly fucking right. So to me, when you talk about the suicide piece and being traumatized to check into your unit, that's one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is EMI takes congressional approval to do. It's a joke. Nobody would do it. And then you got to supervise the whole thing. So you have a wife and kids. You're punishing yourself. because of this idiot.
Well, you got to be able. That's what I said. Sacrifice. There was a lot of weekends I was not at home.
Right. But I mean,
and there were a lot of times I'd come home at 11 o'clock at night.
And now it's worse, right? In terms of trying to take corrective action in their best interest, now to try to do that in the Marine Corps, act of Congress. And so to me, there's two sides of this. There's got to be some respect for authority, right? And it appears to me that the Marine Corps is going the way of the public school system in that understanding, your feelings, staff NCOs, you can't do this anymore. If you're late for a formation but you texted us, that's okay. You know, what? So to me, there's got to be an equilibrium that we find as a modern culture where you can coexist in an organization that embraces discipline, that knows that you need discipline, because if you don't have it, more of you are going to die. At least in the initial battles. And then after that, guys like Mike are going to take over, and they're going to start doing the right thing and say, fuck the rules. And at that point, nobody cares about the rules because you're fighting. And then in the initial contacts, a lot of guys are going to die that shouldn't die. And maybe that's the price you pay for it. But I don't know.
One effective tool that I used to do, because I was, I'm not a big guy, but I'm fast, I'm strong, and I'm smart. So I was always telling people, I may not be strong as you. I may not win the fight, but I'm not going to back down. If you want to fight, I'll fight. But what we're not going to do is we're not going to do that. We're not going to come to blows. But here's what we're going to do. I'm going to run the PT session. So I did this a lot at LAR when I was a staff sergeant. Because at first I had some unruly guys, man. They were testing the waters. And so the first run we went on, and I could run forever. And so the first run we went on, we were...
Now, is this before or after? This is after your car accident.
Oh, this is well after, Even after my car accident, that's when I really... Because I ran so much, and then for my physical therapy, I swam and swimming a lot and biking a lot. And that's when I started doing, like, triathlons and Ironmans when I was really young. So it was like, okay, I'm getting faster. I can swim faster. I can swim longer. I can bike longer. I was biking. You know, when I wasn't married, I was living on base. I would bike 120 miles a day on the weekends.
Wow.
And but I love that. I mean, to get on PCH, I'd bike down to San Diego and back just in time for dinner. Grab lunch on the way. And I'd do that Saturday. Get up early in the morning, sun's coming up, get on the bike up to PCH, and then head down the freeway. Go all the way down to San Diego, go all the way down to Imperial Beach Pier, grab lunch, grab something light to eat, and then get back on the bike and come home. Your motivation is there's no other way home. Okay. It's great motivation. And then I would swim, and I'd swim in the ocean. I would just swim, I'd go out to Red Beach right up there, and then just swim straight out. Until I got a little bit tired, or I was, you start to feel like that sweat,
in the water.
In the water. And then I turned around and swim back. So I did that a lot. And I really didn't do a lot of the gym stuff, but I was running. And then Mateo, you're surrounded by hills. So I'd always run up First Sergeant's Hill or up to the LZ. That was always an ass kicker because the LZ is like a straight up run. There's no flat ground. It's just always a climb.
That's crazy. That's crazy, PT. I mean,
I would do that all the time, and I loved it. I was a 300 PFTer until I was a staff sergeant, until someone said, I'm a first-class PFTer when I do 3 pull-ups, 40 sit-ups, and run the run in 26 minutes. You're a first-class PFTer, even though you got a 300. It doesn't matter. I'm like, what? All right. So... That's when my decline. I always tell people my decline is when I became a staff sergeant. I was like, oh, there's a loophole. I'm gonna jump in it. But so I'd take these guys on the beach, and we'd run. And we would run. And if I was in a bad mood, they put me in a bad mood that day. We ran on the beach, not on the water side where the sand is kind of hard packed. We'd run on the sandy side.
No.
You are getting 3 times more workout, right?
Three? Come on.
Yeah, if it's to run in that loose sand.
It's more than three. It's not
it
three.
It was an ass kicker. And I would run and run and run and run and run. And until I could hear people puking, until my formation was so spread out, it was just me and maybe three of my NCOs. And then we'd loop back around, and I'd always tell them, okay, that last guy, what we're going to do is we're going to run all the way to this point, and then we're going to run all the way back, pick him up, and then once we get to him, we're going to run back. So you're constantly adding more time as I loop all the way back to pick him up, keep him in the formation until he straggles out again, and once he falls back, I run all the way back. So you're running in these loop donuts as you're going forward. And that's, you know, so a three-mile run is like 8 miles. And, man, it was great. And so they realized real quick, like, okay. But I was there at, you know, at 5:30 in the morning. I was the first one to wake him up.
Now you'd be accused of – that's punitive PT. You're hazing us now. You're harassing
us.
No,
I'm not hazing. I'm making you stronger.
Right, well, you know, but again, that, is that tool – can you still do that? I don't think you can, Mike. Somebody's going to walk in and say – yeah, somebody's going to say he's hazing us by through PT. And so it's like, look, the Marine Corps needs – this is me from again, the different – people that I talk to, and not just my sons, but like as I talk about post-traumatic winning, and you get into issues that leaders in the division and in regiments and battalions face, and what their concerns are. Hey, are you going to address this? Are you going to address that? What you is that we very much as a nation, the Marine Corps is a reflection of it, are searching for a way to turn young people who haven't encountered discipline, and any imposition of it is hazing and harassment to them.
Right.
How do you bring them into this organization? And then you think you're going to fight on a decentralized battlefield where these NCOs are going to take control, but you don't give – they don't have any authority. EMI? Right. Yeah, well, the Commandant has to sign off on that now. So we'll give me the package and we'll send it to Headquarters Marine Corps. You know, it's bullshit. And how does it work like that? And so I think the Marine Corps is an unsettled place, as are a lot of places. Universities are unsettled. I remember during the Marines United thing, a friend of mine who general officers told me that, you know, General Kennedy, he was the head of Marine Corps Recruiting Command at the time. He said, you know, I deal with a lot of universities and I talk and go to educational association things. They're very interested to see how we're going to handle this because they deal with this all the time. Starting in elementary school because kids have phones. And I like, oh man, I guess I never thought about it like that. So how are you going to respond to this kind of online issue that's now gone from, you know, grammar schools to middle school to high school to college, now into the military? Logical progressions. They're doing the same things they've done. How are you going to react? So, and how do you continue to be a disciplined organization, knowing that you have to be that in this modern society we live in that wants nothing to do with the D word? So, it's, and I think, Mike, your style of leadership, you would still win today because you would figure it the fuck out. Oh.
Yeah, you got to be smart about it. You can't be stupid.
Right.
I mean, you can't.
But again, I mean, you're exceptional.
Yeah, but when I was young, I mean, I mean, I put my hands maybe on one or two people.
Yeah, but I don't think you need, but the rest of those people, and again, I'm not talking about those people, because those people, you would still, instead of putting your hands on them right now, you'd NJP them. Get them out of here.
Well, and I was really good, I would document everything. And then as soon as, what I see a lack of today is people sitting down and saying, hey, here's your shortfalls, here's what you need to do to attain this, and here's the timeline I'm going to give it you. What do you need? I will be here for you. Let me know what you need. What is lacking? Because I don't want them to come back, well, I didn't know because no one taught me. Okay, I'll teach you. I didn't know because I didn't know where to get it. I'll get it for you. What is it you need? And most of the time I gave it to him. You know, and I tell the story of when I was at the regiment, and we had a staff sergeant, an 0369, who had never been to school. And this is where it started with me when I got to the division was, and so when I approached him and said, you know, I looked at your record. He was one of those guys. He's in the Marine Corps 13 years. But if you tallied up all the time that he was actually in an operational unit, like a fire team, a squad, a platoon, or a company, it was like less than a year. And I'm like, what? Huh? And he's now in our S shop in the regiment. You know, he's in the S3. And I'm looking at him going, how are you here? So I'm sitting there in front of him. I said, okay, I'm looking at this. You were first came in. You were in this unit. You were a fire team member, your rifleman. What happened after that? Well, so they put me in the S4 shop. Okay. So you made a deployment, not as a rifleman, but in the S4. Yes, sir. Then what happened? You became a Lance Corporal. Corporal, I see you're in this battalion. What'd you do in that battalion? Sir, I was in the S3 shop. I was a clerk. So you never, other than School of Infantry, that's the only time you shot a machine gun. Yes, sir. Okay, because you're a machine gun. Yes. Okay. So then you became a sergeant. You went on B billet. You did this. You know, he was, I think, MSG. So he came back, and then he got promoted, you know, meritorious or something like that, to staff sergeant, or advanced pretty quickly. And then he's been a staff sergeant for like 6 years, 7 years. And I'm thinking to myself, well, shit, that's a long time, you know. So what do you need to do? We need to send you to school. And he goes, oh, sir, I'm already scheduled for the academy, staff academy. I said, oh, yeah, we're not going there. You're not going there. You're going to platoon sergeant course. Because as soon as you graduate platoon sergeant course, you're going to go to 2-1 and be a platoon sergeant. I've already talked to those guys. I don't want you in the regimental 3 shop. And the 3 at the time was like, you know, he didn't care. You know, I told him I was going to do it. He's like, all right, yeah, cool. So, and normally I didn't get involved in the 3 matters because, you know, that's something I'm doing other shit. But I was bored, and I saw this guy. And so I went down there, we signed him up, and we sent him off to school. And I was the only, and what really pissed me off when I became the division gunner, and I changed this, I was the only Marine gunner on Camp Pendleton at the time that actually had an email. I was on the email list for every student that was in the course and from my unit. So if they came in, they checked in from First Regiment. Every Friday they do the instructors down there, phenomenal professionals, would do a roll-up of what they accomplished that week and where they stand in the class. And they'd send that out as an email. And what really pissed me off was there was not a lot of unit representation on those emails. Yeah. But everybody in my regiment, when I came down there, I told them, I said, I don't care who they are. If they check in from 1st Marine Regiment, you know, 142112131, I'm on the email distribution list. And they're like, Roger, sir. So I was. And so I'd look at that. I'd read that email. So Monday morning, if they were screwing up, I'm at SOI before I get to work. And I'm stopping in, and I'm already called ahead, and I'm pulling the kid from class, and I'm sitting in the conference room, and I'm like, okay. And I got the email. So what happened? How'd you get a 75 on this test? And they're like, and I said, oh, let me introduce myself. I'm your regimental gunner. We have never met. But so why did you get a 75 from this test? Well, I didn't. And so what are we going to do to get this thing up? You know, because minimal is not this. You know, so I was really engaged that way. And then if they screwed up, I was on every board. Every guy that regiment had, I'd sit on a board, you know, as an outside guy, because they had their own people on the board, their own instructors, and they would review this guy, and they'd make a determination whether or not they're going to keep him. And I became the only guy from the outside of this command that actually would speak at the board. And first thing I always told the Marine, and they're standing there, I'm not here on your behalf, all right? I'm on here on behalf of the regiment. I'm looking out for the regiment, what's best for the regiment. And what's best for the regiment is to kick your ass out of the Marine Corps. I'll sign the papers now. But let's get to this. We're going to make that determination today. So we would do this, and it was really a good program. So then when I became the division, I ordered everybody to do it. I made it a policy, had the general sign it. I mean, because I had to, you have to force people to be leaders. That's what I found out.
Which is so maddening, right?
They're but that's guys. The way you have to be.
You're guys. You're supposed to love them. You're supposed to be involved. This is all Mike was doing was executing the sixth step in troop leading for his guys.
Yeah, the capitalists.
Yeah. But, supervision. That's you're sending them to school. You're monitoring this shit. Blah 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 blah. So success is not doesn't happen by fiat. It doesn't happen by chance. It happens because we kick it, drag it, and punch it through there every time. That's how it happens.
Very, very rarely in my 31 years did leadership happen by Ferrari, where it's beautiful, just beautiful by looking at it, man. It was the beat up Chevy Malibu, 67, rusted out bottom, no seats, the top torn off, so holes in it. I mean, it got you there, but you didn't look pretty and it wasn't pleasant getting there. It was.
Yeah, it looks like the Clampett's rolling down the road.
And it was crap, but you got there.
Yeah, but you, and again, the front part of the car is really nice and shiny, right? And those guys will always, they're, but when you go from the middle and you start working yourself back, you're dragging people at the end, right? You're dragging them through, and that's what the back end of the Clampett's truck looks like.
Yeah.
But it's guys like Mike that are making sure that those last guys get through. And if you don't have a guy like Mike doing that, your shit's strung out forever and you're fucked up. And
so.
But that's
here's how people hated me though.
That's normal though.
I was known by some to throw people on the bus. I was being unprofessional, and this is how I was unprofessional. So one day we go up to 7th Marines.
No, you're gonna tell me another version of the Firewatch story, right?
No. This is great.
I don't want
this
you to don't tell them I'm sleeping because I'm not gonna be. Tell them I'm sleeping. I'm going someplace else. You're not supposed to be honest and tell the truth.
No, this is great though. This is what the Marine Corps is at though. This is where they're at. This is their problem. The general goes up, and every time we show up with the general, they do a brief.
Yes.
The status da 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 da. And so this day, this captain and first sergeant from this company that's going to execute this thing going overseas, they had two guys in the platoon sergeant's course that had failed and were kicked out. And so as we're going around, we're talking, and I said, and it came to me, and they said, Gunner, what are you? I said, hey, First Sergeant Captain, the two guys that you had failed, they're not going with you, right? Because it was against policy. They couldn't deploy. They had to go back to school. Well, we're going to send them back to school when we get back. And the general intervened and said, no, wrong answer. And I said, also, I noticed on the email distribution, you weren't on there when they were told that they were going to fail. For the last 3 weeks, no one from the unit contacted the school. And Jay Bergeron, who was a buddy of mine, who's a regimental commander, I told him ahead of time I was going to do this. And he was like, fine, you need to do it. But you could feel the cold wind of death, Reaper coming in, the sigh getting ready, And the general looked at me and he was like, this gentleman is unacceptable. And General Nicholson, he was a leader.
Right.
And he gave his leadership speech. And his leadership speech at that point was, either you can be on the team or not. I don't need you. I'll find someone else to replace you. Which meant, start typing your resume, because you ain't going to have a job in the Marine Corps much longer. But that's what it had to come down to get these guys to do their job.
Okay, let me give you another side of that. We're going to send Staff Sergeant Musselman, who we like, who's a good performer, to the Staff NCO Academy. Okay? All right. This is good. We get off deployment. We're home for 30 days. He goes to check in. He fails the inventory PFT.
Oh, it happened all the time.
Right?
Or he was overweight.
Comes back to the unit. Do we paper that? He's a good guy.
And he goes right back to his old job.
Right.
Yeah. Goes right back to being in his job. Yeah. Yep. That's what happened a lot. And we talked about this when we were in Afghanistan was, what do you tell parents? So I'm sorry your son was lost in combat, but the guy we had leading him, you shouldn't have been there. Made bad decisions. Do you want that? Do you want to say that to somebody?
Can't. No, can't. Right? We all pray that the family never finds out that their kid shouldn't be dead. That nobody
well,
tells
because
them.
He was let down by bad leadership.
Nobody.
But
tells.
How many people were killed through bad leadership? One. I know more than one.
Yeah. No. No, and it's heartbreaking. And where does that start? It starts by not having the courage just to do the right thing. And this kind of code, the pirate code, that we don't out somebody who's a substandard performer because he's a good guy. We don't pay for him because he was sent home from the staff academy because he couldn't pass inventory PFT because he knew he was going, didn't get off his ass in PFT, and now he wants us to cut him a husk.
Or he's married and he's got kids.
It doesn't work like that, though.
Well, he shouldn't have thought about that.
Yeah.
But that's what, that's what the staff sergeant tells me after the second time he fails. He comes back to my office and I tell him, I'm already done the paperwork. We're going to admin step you from the Marine Corps. What? What do you mean? Explain to me how I'm lost here. I don't understand why you're look this confused face on it. I mean, don't you have to be in the Marine Corps? You got to be a Marine. Right? Right? It's in the title? To join the Marine Corps, you got to accept the fact that you got to be a Marine. Does everybody understand that? Okay, here's the parameters of being a Marine. You don't fit that, you're not a Marine. And if you're not a Marine, you can't be in the Marine Corps. Simple. I don't understand. But I didn't know. What about my children? What do you mean, what about my children? That's not my problem.
It's your problem.
You didn't think of them when you were out gallivanting last weekend instead of studying then failed on Monday?
The last month when you haven't PT to lick?
Yeah, what?
Haven't been able to squeeze PT into some hour of your day on your 30 days of libo leave?
Yeah. No. And don't give me this, oh, my life, I'm always deployed and da-da-da. You know, it's like, we'll get him on the show and we'll talk about him. It's A.J. Pasciuti. Brand new minted gunner out in Hawaii. Pasciuti, I was laughing because he called me up and he said, hey, sir, he was a gunny. He was working at the MARSOC guy, you know. He's like, hey, I'd like to see if you could write me a letter of recommendation. I said, for what? He said, to be in the gunner program. I said, no, Pasciuti, I don't want you to be a gunner because life's going to suck. You know, you may think it's all looks cool, but it's going to suck. You're going to be, there's going to be no pat on the back. You're going to be working long hours. Hell, if you make it through with your wife, after a couple years, you'll be part of the minority. Life sucks because you're constantly going to be gone. So I wrote this long-ass letter, who AJ really was. Well, he got accepted in the program, and then now he's out in Hawaii being a gunner. So we were talking about it. I said, so you like it? He goes, oh, my God. Not only do I like it, I love it. You know, I'm always doing this. I'm on this. I'm catching a C-130 right now. I'm on the tarmac talking to you. I'm in Thailand. And then I'm flying back to Hawaii, get my unit out here. And then from here, I'm going to fly out to the Philippines because that's where they're going to go. I mean, he's just – because that's the way he is. And I said, is it the way he expected? And he goes, no, it's harder. But I love it. And – he's like, I blame this. Well, he said, I blame it on you because you're the is when I was his gunner, he's like, that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be like that guy because he was always there. He was listening to us. He could be a lance corporal on a rooftop one day, patrolling with us, be like one of the boys. And then when it needed to, he's doing this. And he goes, that's what I'm striving to do. And he's having a blast. But I can tell everybody that wants to be a gunner, you don't want to do this. The job sucks. Because everything, the demand goes up. Matt Anderson, who used to work for me in 3-5, same thing. He was one of my instructors at ITB, wanted to be a gunner. Now he just got selected CWO-5, going to be the division gunner down at 4th Marine Division. He's a great guy. Matt is one of the best, But I look at some of those guys and those guys all have it too. But they strive for, they want to become gunners because, you know, they saw what you can do as a gunner, what you can affect, what you can change.
Right.
If you were willing to go outside of the box.
That's the upside. And the downside, yeah, the downside is if
you got to give your life, man. You think it was bad before?
Not even
strap
close.
On.
Not even close. Let me read you this email. Mac, it sounds like there is a disconnect someplace in the Marine Corps between what the gunner talks about, loving them and caring enough to train them. It doesn't seem like a lot of people can do that. And can, while they're doing that, can convince Marines of the benefits of this. Am I off base? I don't think the email's off base. I think that's right.
I think you're on base. Exactly.
Yeah, but again, Mike's exceptional. How do you
convince somebody you like them by making them work their ass off?
And having them being pissed at you.
Usually people come across as that's the guy's a dickhead.
Do you have the personality to overcome all of that and win them ultimately over?
Or are you willing to do it too? You know, Mac worked in a, we had two buildings, in Afghanistan. We had the COC, it was one building, and then the offices of the staff on the other side. And then it was connected by like a little breezeway or a little patio. But they're made out of wood and, you know, they're not airtight, they're not things, but they'd get dusty and everything else. So I'd come in the morning, the first thing I'd do is sweep my office. And then I'd take the big push broom and I'd sweep the whole hallway from the colonel's all the way down to the hatch. Everybody's in front of everybody's office. Catch everything up. And so when I did that first, one of the Marines said, "Oh, sir, you don't have to do that." And I said, "Well, I have to do that because no one else is doing it." And they said, "No, sir, I got it." And they took the broom. So the next day I'd come in and I'm sweeping. And, "Sir, you don't have to do that." And I said, "I have to. No one's doing it. They take the broom." The third day I came in, they're sweeping the fucking hallway by themselves. The fourth day, they're sweeping the hallway. The seventh day, it's an SOP. They get it. I never told anybody to do it, but they thought in their mind, well, shit, if that guy, CW4, thinks it's important, then it must be important. And he's doing it himself. Or, if you're willing to stay in late and come in early and you don't say anything, I don't expect you to be here. I come in early because I want to get ahead of everything. I want to be there first. I used to wake up. I used to set my alarm in my sleeping bag on my watch 45 minutes before everybody else. So if Reveille was 4:30 in the morning, I'm getting up at, you know, 3:15. And the reason why was – because I wanted to get dressed, I wanted to pack my gear, I wanted to shave, I wanted to eat. So when everybody's waking up, I'm done. All I got to do now is put fire in ass. You know? And that's what it comes down to. And I'm the last one to bed. And I stay up, and as Firewatch is up there, I walk over there to Firewatch, and we're sitting around, and it's the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, and I'm sitting there, and I say, "So where are you from? You got any kids? Where'd you go to high school? What'd you play? You go to sports." And if we don't have anything in common, I make shit up to bond. "You used to build models?" "Yeah, so did I." "So you're a dork. You're a nerd like me." "That's great." You know, "You got a picture of your girlfriend?" You know, and I'd do this, or I'd wake up, you know, and spend time, walk around. I'd give them stuff. You know, shit, a bottle of Gatorade. When I used to go from Dwyer out, half of my pack was filled with pogie bait and ghee dunk. You know, and that's snacks and shit that we shouldn't have. Not contraband, but, I mean, just candy and shit like that that we had access to at Dwyer and the base, the PX there, that these guys didn't have because they were 7 months in a freaking shithole, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. And then every once in a while, like every other month, the PX truck would come into the base, and if they were lucky enough to be on their FOB when it came in, they could buy shit. So I'd fly out there and I'd stay with this platoon out in the middle of nowhere. And at night, when everybody's kind of joking around the fire, we're talking, telling stories and lying about our accomplishments in the Marine Corps, I'd give all the shit out. Hey guys, I brought you this stuff because I know, Oh fuck, I haven't seen a pistachio in 7 months. Oh, these things taste so good. Or, everybody got beef jerky, but I mean, some of the shit that they'd see, just bring it. Or bring magazines. Here you guys go. Don't tell them where you got them. Oh, sure. Jugs again? Oh, this is great.
But you used it to open a door to get access.
Yeah, I'd open the door, get access, and then find out what's wrong. What do they need? What are they willing to, what do they want? But I was also really good at covering my informants. I would never do like, hey, Mike McNamara told me. No, because I'd own it.
Right.
You know, Mac McNamara comes to me and says, Gunner, I need you to do this. Yeah. I don't go out there in front of the guys and go, okay, hey, the boss wants us to go and do this.
I know this is fucked up, but.
Yeah, what you're telling everybody is you didn't want to do this either. You come out and you say, hey, we're going to do this, and don't tell the boss because I want him to be surprised. But we're going to do this. Keep it to ourselves. And so some of my lieutenants that I had as a staff sergeant, they were great. And I had one that was a little hard-headed because he was prior enlisted. And I pulled, we took a walk outside one day and I said, hey, listen, we're in this together, man. Do you want to win? Do you want to be successful? He's like, yeah. I said, okay, we're a team. Quit fighting me. All right? If you come up and say that the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, I'm going to back you. Everybody's going to know I'm an idiot, but I'm going to back you. That's the way it works here. So don't be an idiot. Don't say anything. We communicate before we go, we do it, okay? We talk. We share ideas. Because in the 12 months that you're here, you leave. I'm still here, buddy. And so are these guys. And then we got a new one. And then he leaves. I'm still here. Okay? So we're not going to try and change things. These are the way it works. You conform to us. This is the way it works. And a lot of them, I mean, they were like, yeah. And we were. And I tell my guys, and I stay in touch with them a lot. And, especially the LAR guys. And I always just tell them, I said, this is the punishment you get for being good. And, my platoon. And they're like, they saw it. Because they said it in a post not too long ago. They go, looking back, we worked our asses off. We were always point man. For the company or the battalion, the platoon was always leading the way. We were always, the battalion would do a battalion movement and it was always second platoon, Bravo company, your point for this, you're the pathfinders. You're going to find this, you're going to do this, you're going to do this. I mean, we're the first one out there, we're the last one, we're always moving, but you get that reward for being good. Like, what do you guys want to do? Be in the back? Be in the middle of the pack? No, we're out here at 4 LEVs. The battalion is 120 miles away. We're out by ourselves, man. This is as great as it gets. Because they trust us, they know us, and we're that good.
And all you have to do to fuck it all up is show our ass, right? And then we're going to get somebody that says we need to be supervised. So for us to stay out here, right?
Right.
Our shit's got to be tight. And then we are kings of the world. We will be having drag races across Quackenbush Lake going 60 miles an hour. Okay? And nobody will know because we'll be left alone.
Right. And they got it. They were like, and they knew it. But there was a price to pay for being good.
You got to be good.
Yeah. You were the racehorse, man. You were the one that was going to bring home the wreath every time.
But again, Mike, how do we teach that? I mean, it seems like it shouldn't be hard because what you're talking about is the personal part of leadership. Like, the traits and wah, 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 get that out of here.
I never knew what the traits were.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you. I could like clean, reverent, obedient. Those might be Boy Scouts, but like, I think they're like, okay, whatever. Somebody teach me, what do I have? So I have to get up 45 minutes early? right? That's what I should do. So when my when my guys are going to school, I see there's a mailing list. I should get on that. Yeah. Somebody show me the coordinating instructions on how to be good. And it doesn't.
Oh, that's what they're waiting for.
Right. And again, some are waiting for it. Others, you'll give it to them and they'll just blow it off. But there'll be some that take it. And what you're trying to do. And then here's to me, this is a lesson from General Mattis. I think once somebody becomes a leader, you should get rid of those guys as quick as you need to. And that's what General Mattis did. And what that does is it scares the shit out of the mediocre ones, and they perform at, instead of being mediocre, they become above average. And so if you can imagine the bell curve, all of a sudden everything lifts up. That's what happened in the 1st Marine Division, especially among the officers, because everybody was afraid that if he showed up and your shit was ragged, you
being
were
good wasn't good enough.
Yeah, you were going to get your ass fired. And so to me, there's and again, I've had discussions like, it'd be better to be like Dunford, everybody loves you and blah, blah. Yeah, okay, not everybody's like that. There should be an element of fear from somebody that if I don't do my shit, if I'm not on it, failing a PFT, an inventory PFT, so you're going to show up to school, and you know how fucked up you have to be to fail the inventory PFT? And then you get sent home and we don't paper it because we like you? All you're doing is subsidizing, right, poor leaders with some excuse. Well, I just got off deployment, so you couldn't go run and do, 20 pull-ups a day and do 80 sit-ups. That takes you at least 45 minutes, probably not even that.
Right.
So it's just, how do you take a horse to water? You stick his head in the lake, right? How do you make him drink it? And then, I think guys like you need to be regulars at leadership schools. And
you know how you make a horse drink? You know, you said that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Yeah, you can. You know how? You break his ass getting to the water. You make him so damn tired and so thirsty that when he gets there, he can't stop drinking. But you're right. You can lead anything to water, and you can make them drink. It's just how you get there. You take your time, and you're lazy about it, and you joke about it. Yeah, when you get there, I'm not in the mood. But, man, you break their ass, and you do everything possible. So when they get there, they're like, oh, salvation. That's the trick, man.
Salvation. Listen, Reverend Musselman here on All Marine Radio. All right, what else you got? What else you got going on today? Anything?
Nope.
Any birthday parties? Any weddings you getting ready for? Any?
No. Nothing. Nothing. Doctor's appointment next week, 19th. Then we go on vacation.
Which doctor?
This is my surgery one. So I find out, I'm going to schedule my surgery now.
What surgery are we talking about?
The nose.
Oh, yeah, we're going to free up the nose. How fired up are you for that?
I'm okay.
What are they going to do? Are they going to reshape your nose? Are they going to shave it down a little bit so you can have Kim Kardashian nose?
No, I'm thinking more like a Mike Tyson.
They're going to bore it out.
I want it to look like I've been in a boxer my whole life.
There you go. That'll wait. People will leave me alone.
Right. So we're looking at being in Camp Lejeune, 6th through the 11th or the 12th.
Yeah. Travel on the 6th and the 12th. And then 5 days doing it twice a day. And then probably one evening for spouses.
So then, I'm looking to do surgery like the week after, the 14th to the 21st.
Nice. And then what are they actually going to do to your nose?
They're going to repair the deviated septum, and then they're going to drill out. They're going to make it so I can use my nasal cavities.
Nice. How fired up are you for that?
I'll see afterwards. I just hope they don't screw it up. and I walk out of there with some kind of weird looking nose. It's not plastic surgery, so they're not reshaping my nose. They're just, well, I guess they are. Their septum is, they're fixing the septum. Which, I like the shape of my nose, so I don't want to do anything. I just wanted to, I mean, if it's me going to sleep and then taking a power drill and just drilling it, that's fine. Do what you want. I just don't want to look like I got a nose job when I'm in, you know, the bandages on your nose and the two black eyes. Like people walking around going, God, how vain is that guy? He had a nose job.
He had a nose job. I only wish I'd lived.
No, I didn't get a nose job. I got my nose broken because someone said something stupid to me. Oh. So, yeah, that's what's coming up. That's what's on the big ticket. Then we go to Colorado
next week.
Oh.
21st.
The other element is, what's her code name? Do we, Henrietta? We don't. It's not Henrietta.
No, we can't say that.
Not Henrietta.
Code name.
Code.
What did it say? Code name.
The code name.
The code name. Yeah. So code name.
Code name is there. All right, man. Have a good day.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
There you have it. The one and only Michael Musselman here on a Thursday. Why? Yeah. Interesting question. Why? Why do some get it and others not? And who can you give it to? So, timeless questions of leadership. That was a bit rambling. That's how we do it, though. Sorry about that. That'll do it on a Thursday. Just joining us, don't touch that dial, Jeff Kenney in a Why We Hate Donald Rumsfeld segment. You're going to hear that. You're going to hear about me rediscovering Bruce Springsteen. If you're a Springsteen fan, he's done a show on Broadway for a while. So he just concluded his show, and I think you can see it on Netflix. And so I was talking about kind of rediscovering, watching a little bit like that. And so you heard me talk about that, Jeff Kenney, and why we hate Don Rumsfeld so much. We're supposed to talk about Afghanistan, but we're going to have to do that next time. So anyway, he's great to have on. So don't touch that dial, whatever you do. And again, I would tell you, don't be afraid to turn off the news. It's not going to get better, and I don't know how much of it is good for your life anyway and how much you need. If you are newsy, the Associated Press app that you can download to your phone will give you the important things that you need to know. Other than that, I would say turn a lot of that stuff off. Doesn't make you happier. So on that life advice, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. But on a Thursday, I am over and out. And